Welcome to this week's episode of Zen Founder. Two announcements before we get started. The first is that this week is the last week to sign up for the current Zen Tribe. If you go to zenfounder.com/zentribes, you can get more information. But Zen Tribes are groups of 6 to 8 entrepreneurs who commit to meeting weekly for 8 weeks. Sherry leads you remotely via, I think it's Zoom these days, and offers the place, people, time, and guidance to tackle the unique struggles and challenges that you experience as an entrepreneur. So if you feel like you need some community with other founders, like you're out there floating on your own, and you need to connect with other folks and kind of be guided into that next phase of entrepreneurship, now is the time to head to zenfounder.com/zentribes. In addition, the book is coming out very soon. The book is The Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together, How to Run Your Business Without Letting It Run You. And the book is about learning how to master your stress, dismiss your fears, and rapidly accelerate your business growth. So it's a lot of what we talk about here on Zen Founder, and a lot that we haven't talked about. It's so much of the knowledge and wisdom that Sherry and I have learned from interviewing founders, being founders ourselves, and you know, from Sherry's deep knowledge of what it takes and the stress that surrounds being a founder. So if you haven't signed up, zenfounder.com/book will get you to the book landing page. I would highly encourage you to check it out because we're going to be launching in the next few weeks. There's a print version, it's going to be a Kindle version, audio version, all the things you'd want, and you want to be first on that list to hear about it. And finally, this week's episode of Zen Founder is Sherry interviewing Ryan Tansom of the Life After Business podcast. It's a great interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
We know this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Zen founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
Well, Ryan, it is so great to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me. And we met at Rhodium Weekend last fall, which was a great conference. Both you and I were part of the speaking docket that year. And unfortunately, I didn't get to hear your talk, but I got to talk with you enough to know that I want to talk with you more. So it's been fun to get to know you a little bit since we're both Minneapolis based.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm on the show.
Yeah. So I am excited to learn more about your story and talk about the process of reinventing yourself a couple different times as a professional, even at a young age. So maybe we could start out just by giving us the kind of short version of these two companies that you have been deeply part of, one you sold and one you're now starting from scratch. So what's the quick roadmap of your life as a professional so far?
Right. Keep it brief, right? So my dad, it starts actually with him because he was an entrepreneur, started multiple companies, and the imaging path, which he started in the mid-90s, he actually mortgaged our house and bought a semi-truck full of copiers. He had 30 days to sell them. Well, needless to say, he did. And over the next 10 years, he grew a $20 million business, had about 100 employees, selling copiers and servicing them. And I worked in and out of my the family business my entire childhood and growing up. And, you know, I just totally got the taste of being an entrepreneur. And what ended up happening right around the financial crisis, I decided to join full time. And around that time, Xerox, there was a company called Global that was doing this national roll up with a bunch of different equipment dealers in different cities. And with the 20 million and 11 and 100 employees, we were kind of right in the sweet spot. And they decided to pass on us. So that was kind of a big aha moment for us because we found out that here's this business that we've got that provides a lot of cash flow and a lot of fun stuff, and it's not transferable, not worth anything. So we spent the next 6-7 years completely turning around the business, you know, doing all the a lot of different in operational stuff, employee stuff, and built out the outsourced IT and software side of the business to kind of become that full technology provider that we knew we needed to be. And ended up having a couple different circumstances that led us to sell the business in 2014 to a local competitor. And then since then, I had to kind of create myself because I didn't, I found out that I'm professionally unemployable because I don't like to work for other people. And
you and me both, brother.
Right. Yeah. It's I'm a bull in a china shop and we're having a committee meetings with 10 people and no one can make a decision. So what ended up happening is I partnered with my partner now who had an investment management firm. And then I went back and said, you know what? There was a lot of challenges with that whole exit, everything from the tax planning to who and where and how we could sell it to for how much. So him and I have created the firm that I wish I would have had where we do growth and exit planning.
So there's a lot that I want to talk to you about, but let's go back though to when you were a kid, if we could just for a second. And I mean, this story about your dad mortgaging the house to buy a semi-truck full of copiers, you know, some people might see that as kind of a big risk. That's a pretty scary move for, you know, someone who has a house and a family. How do you think about that risk that your dad took way back when?
It's interesting. He always said that we would have a pool. He just never said whether it was going to be at the apartment complex or at our house. So I think I look at it a lot differently now because I've in turn done the same thing. So, you know, I think the risk as an entrepreneur is less risk in your head because you feel confident in your abilities to do it. So as an outsider looking at what he did, I think a lot of people would think he's crazy. But, you know, now being in the same position, have taken the original risk myself, I think it's less risk in your mind because you kind of have eyes wide open when you're going into it.
You have a sense of where those copiers are going to go.
Yeah, I didn't at that point. He had a feeling that he could figure out how to sell all of them. You know, I'm not as passionate about copiers as he was, so I don't think I would have had as much success. But I think it has to do with having passion to be able to whatever your truckload of copiers is in your world. I think it's having the passion that'll actually get you to actually accomplish that piece.
What has risk looked like for you? You've done this yourself now, sold one company, started another one. So what have been your kind of moments of big risk and how have you thought about them?
That's a good question. You know, it was interesting as I was, you know, sitting at the trenches with my dad because, you know, even though I did not start the company like he did, we were in the trenches at the last, you know, handful of years together side by side. And it was the risk of keeping it going and knowing that that was my future legacy. I did not have the complete attachment that he did because it was his baby, even though I kind of adopted it halfway through. So I think I looked at that risk differently because I saw it was almost like where you see the future vision of where your life's going to go. And the risk of that vision not happening is just kind of terrifying. So that's kind of like an emotional risk of where you want to go versus the financial risk that my dad had. Like if for some reason something would happen, he would have lost a lot more financially than I would have. But, you know, it was the future vision that I had painted for myself was at risk at any given point. But now risk is, you know, it's more of trying to trudge through and break through a different industry. And it's taken financial risks as far as building the business. We've invested in software and in relationships, some that have worked, some that have not. So I think it's a little bit more of the mechanics of the risk now that it's my business.
It feels less emotional and more mechanical. Is that one way of summarizing that?
Well, I'd say it's more emotional and more financially because I've got all the financial risk into it now versus, you know, before where it was more the emotional risk where now it is truly your baby because it's all the stuff that you're working your ass off to do every day.
You've got all the skin in the game.
100%. So does my wife.
Yeah. How has it been for her to go from, you know, one version of your professional life that was, you know, family business, pretty well established, had been going for a long time, to the sale, then to starting something new, which sounds like is going super well, but might have some more insecurities than the first business?
She's a saint. Let's put it that way. So in 1 month, we sold the business. I took the proceeds, bought a house and a truck because I said, we're not going to make any money for a while and we're not going to be able to buy anything. And then invested the money into the business and hit the ground running. So all while trying to have a kid. So she was just like, I don't care what you do, just give me a child. So we have two, thank God. So I overcommitted. But I think the one of the biggest differences is when we actually were talking about it a couple nights ago, it was I have completely lost the ability to shut it off. Where before, I think the emotional and the fact that it wasn't my baby from birth, like my dad birthed the company, I was able to kind of shut it off a little bit easier on the weekends and stuff versus now where it's just like literally become a part of the thoughts in my head constantly.
And she's cool with that?
I'm working. It's just constant work. You know, we talk a lot about it. It's if we didn't communicate, there's no way it would work out, but we over communicate. And, you know, she actually does a really good job at understanding what I'm trying to accomplish for us. And, you know, I think if this, you know, extrapolated 20 years, we'd have some serious issues, but you know, it's kind of the whole purpose of this is to create a different life for ourselves.
You've taken some of the disorientation, some of the pain points that come with the sale of a company, and used your own pain and the experience of selling a company to really become the vision for what you'd like to do better in the world. And I think that's really neat to sort of take the, you know, these things that were really hard and use that very directly to help other people have a smoother process. What were the things that really stood out for you in the process of selling the company that were just like, hey, we've got to figure out a way to do this better?
It's not knowing your options at all. And I think is so, you know, we were a mid-market company that, you know, a lot of investment bankers and a lot of people would have loved and drooled all over. And they don't tell you what it's like handing off your company to someone else. So like if you were to sell your company to a private equity firm, there's a very good chance that they gut it or they do something to hit a rate of return, you know. And that, you know, we sold to a strategic competitor, which by the way, they're an amazing company and there's a lot of amazing people there. But by the nature of the sale, there's a lot of redundancies with infrastructure, with services, with people, and you gut it in order to, you know, fold our company into theirs. And the ramifications of that, I was completely not really aware of. I knew I was going to, you know, have to go work for someone. I wouldn't be the head honcho anymore. So I spent 3-4 years building out the managed IT services, and it was a crazy amount of painful failures and hires and customers and all this stuff throughout the whole growth of that. And it's all based in software, so it's all code and scripting and processes and procedures and team work that. When we sat in the acquisition meeting and their IT internal engineer was like, yeah, we're just going to shut those servers down. And I just looked at him, I'm like, no way. Like it was like, he just like took my soul and like ripped it apart. I literally went home that night. I was like, done, no chance I can do this, because it was the ramifications of not knowing what the outcome would be like for the culture, the people and your customers and all that stuff that you'd built based on who bought you.
Absolutely. You spend all of this time crafting something that you're proud of and often based on people's ability to trust you and your history of doing right by people, whether that's your customers or your employees. And to hand off like all, you know, all these little babies, so to speak, and just not know for sure that they're going to be cared for in the way that you would take care of them or the way that you would do things.
Every buyer's got a reason for buying your company, whether it's for their intellectual property or some code, or if it's for the people or for cash flow, it's some reason that they're buying your company. So knowing that reason will help you figure out whether it aligns with what your reasons are for selling the company, whether yours is financial or for passing on the culture, the future legacy of where you want your company to go. You have to align those two in order to actually walk away happy.
So how do you help do that differently in your new business and Solidity?
I think the biggest challenge that, you know, what we found out from it kind of unfortunately stems from financials. I was never a financial guy, but, you know, being forced to answer a lot of questions to the bank and really getting the data, you find a way to ask and find information, and information allows you to make better decisions. And once you understand, so I've got 5 key pillars that in my speech that I give that. One is, what kind of lifestyle do you want to live? So what is it that you want to literally do on a day-to-day basis? Is it hang out with people? Is it to lead? Is it to create? Is it to sell? And then once you figure that out, how much does that cost? You know, we did a lot of work trips where, you know, $15,000 fly and fishing trip to Canada is no longer a write-off. So the things that you like to do that is funded by the company, you really have to understand what that lifestyle is that you want. And then you have to The second pillar is knowing your numbers. So how much is your company worth? And it's worth different to different buyers, but how much is it worth? And then, by the way, Uncle Sam comes in and usually takes like half.
Yeah.
So that's a big deal. And so when you're running your numbers and saying, okay, if I sell this company, can I maintain my lifestyle? Like, is if I liquidate this, can I somehow enough have enough money to passively not have to go back to work? Because otherwise you're selling it and then you're going to have to go get a job again. So I think once you have that foundation, then you can say, okay, what are the ways that I need to grow my company to create more value, whether it's adding products or services or contracts? So that's the third key pillar, which is value building in the right ways to increase the value of your company. And then the fourth one is, what are all the exit options available to you? And what exit option you choose will impact your timing, how much you get, and how happy you'll be based on what happens to your customers. So whether you sold, you know, if you were my general manager, whether you sold to someone internally or you sold to a third party or sold to your employees, gifted it to your kids, or there's so many different ways, and you have to be able to back into everything that we just discussed. And then I think the last pillar is, what is the best team to have on your staff or at the table with you? Because I found out the hard way that not all professionals are as smart as their nice suits look.
So you have these five pillars and it all sounds like very logical. Like you walk me through this and I'm like, yeah, okay, good. What's your lifestyle? What do you want? How much does that cost? How do you get your company built up where it has the value to provide the numbers that you need to live the lifestyle that you want? What are your options? You know, it all makes sense. But I know that this is not that easy for people. And, you know, we did a podcast together over on your podcast about some of the emotional entanglements that people experience. But this all sounds like a really nicely laid out plan. It makes great sense. Where does it break down for human beings?
Way before all five of these. This is once you got your head on your shoulders. This is after Sherry talks to them. This is, you know, it's way before this because you have to understand who you are and what makes you you and what you like, because otherwise you can't even do any of this stuff. You can't logically plan because we all do things emotionally and then justify logically. And it's understood, like, I love leading and I love creating. And when we sold our company, I no longer had anybody to lead and I had no longer a platform to create. And that was literally terrible. It was horrible. So knowing that that was important to me is huge. And like, and it's very, unfortunately, a lot of it happens. I actually just interviewed on my podcast this gentleman named Bobby Martin, and John Wardlow interviewed him too. And it was called the $26 million regret. He was literally miserable after he sold. And I could relate a little bit of that because you don't realize that you sell your soul if you don't know what makes you you and what makes you happy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you have to have a sense of what you need to be well in the world. And I've talked to lots of founders about the same sort of question or problem. Sort of recently, Clay Collins was on the program, kind of like the day after he announced that he was stepping down as CEO of LeadPages. So it just happened to be scheduled that day. But, you know, he jumped right into a new startup because he knew that he needed to keep building and keep intellectually engaged and keep having challenges to chase down. And most founders are like that. Certainly the timing of how long you take between one startup and another startup, it matters, right? Not everybody is able to do what Clay did or what you did, which is really like sort of finish and pivot and just go. Some people need different timelines, but.
Well, it's interesting because I think it's almost like for me, it was a little bit out of survival of my sanity. Like, I didn't know who I was otherwise. Like, so I was this guy that was, you know, recognized in the industry for, you know, really doing some cool stuff with the managed IT services and, you know, getting phone calls from vendors across the US, like all this cool stuff. And then all of a sudden, I'm literally irrelevant. And I'm just like, okay, well, I don't have enough of an identity without my company. So, you know, to be identified more as a serial entrepreneur, that in itself is an identity. So instead of LeadPages or a company per se being your identity, it's more of the masters of all of them. So I think a lot of people, unless they've gone through a couple exits, that it's they've only got that one platform to tie their identity to, where, you know, you get into the serial entrepreneurs and it's their whole work of all these companies. That's their story. So I think it's a little bit easier. I don't know if that makes, you know, if that kind of relates to the story.
Yeah. And I do think that from a human development perspective, like that middle adulthood, like 25 to 50. That's building time. Like most of us are building a family. We're building a career. We're building a nest egg. Like we're building things. It's like the busy ant period of human life. And so to be, you know, I'm not sure how old you are, but to be like 30-ish, between 30, 40, 25 to 40, whatever, and all of a sudden have no like building responsibilities or very little building responsibilities is very like antithetical to human development. Like kind of not really built to have that much downtime at that point in our lives.
I called it phantom anxiety. And I went from like 350 emails a day to we woke up, told our 80 employees that we sold the company and like literally didn't get another email. It's just like, okay. So like, you're still like looking down at your phone going like, is the bank there? Is my big customers there? Am I, you know, am I AP, my AR, like all these people that are like constantly needing me are no longer needing me. It's just like really a bizarre, like I said, it's phantom anxiety because the anxiety shouldn't be there technically.
Yeah, you're done. But it's hard to celebrate that when you're also still longing to be making a difference in building something.
Right. There's a institution out there called Halftime. And I've interviewed a couple of the founders on my show. And it's going from success to significance. And sometimes, you know, going to that significance is you don't have to sell your company to get the liquidation event, to get all this money, to go do, you know, sit on the board of a charity. Like sometimes you realize that you can change more people's lives with your company because of the employees that you have direct access to, the vendors, the platform to be able to do other things. So it's maybe another way to look at your relationship with your business and how you can use your business as accomplishing other goals as you reinvent yourself while you own your company instead of doing it afterwards.
That kind of reminds me of your sort of third and fourth pillars, this idea of how do you maximize the value of your company, both financially, but also in terms of like where it lines up with your personal values, the kind of difference that you want to make in the world, and then how you select exit options or consider exit options that are most in line with those personal values. So if your game at this point in your life is about contributing or doing something that has social benefit and social well-being for other people, then how do you sort of leverage your company towards that goal?
Yeah. And I mean, it's so interesting because I do believe that a company is a like a blank canvas for an artist where like the people you hire, the things you do, the things you create is like literally just like you create it and it's a direct reflection of you. So are you familiar with like B corporations like Patagonia or Tom's Shoes where like they have a direct social impact? And if they sold to someone that went away, like what would that do to the owners, to the people? And so like really knowing again what it's really, honestly, Sherry, it comes down to self-awareness, and that takes time usually, and it takes people like yourself or other people to push people to think that way out of the logical quarterly reports and, you know, new product launches and stuff to think about intrinsic, you know, values versus and doing that while you've got a stable infrastructure is a little bit easier because it's less emotionally daunting than sitting at home thinking to yourself all the things that you wish you would have done prior to that.
I agree with you. I think it really starts with that self-awareness, self-knowledge, really knowing your distinctives. Like, this is what I'm about. This is what I give my time and energy to. This is what's important to me. But on top of that, I still think it takes like some guts and courage because it's one thing. It's one thing to start a business and like mortgage the house for the semi-truck full of copiers. I love that image. But just to go all in and saying, I'm taking a risk, I'm going to make this thing. And then it's even another layer to like say, I'm not only in it for my own well-being, but I'm going to figure out how to bring other people along with me in whatever capacity that is, whether that's being a really intentional employer who really values the well-being of your employees, or whether that's having some kind of social mission like a B Corp does. I mean, that's like a whole other level of gutsiness.
Well, I think it's gutsiness that, you know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs fail at because it's very difficult to look into because you don't know the answers and there's no way to quantify it. You can look at a balance sheet and go, yep, killed it, you know, versus like, okay, who am I? How do you make sure that there's no right or wrong answer to that? So it just takes like a way different process and it's not really tangible and measurable sometimes. it's gutsiness to be vulnerable. And then, you know, I mean, and I think the combination of egos that get in the way, but also you're as the entrepreneur and owner and founder, you're looked at to the person that has all the answers. So you put on this facade that you're like totally have all your shit together, when realistically, like, you need to continue to grow and explore. And that's difficult when you have other people staring at you all the time.
Yeah. How do you do that? Because I have my answers for that. But I think you just like epitomize in a way like why Zen Founder exists, because people are always looking at you all the time. And to have a space, whether that's a therapy office or whether a coach or a consultant or a tribe or a group where you can really focus on your own growth, seems like such an important and kind of life-saving part of life for an entrepreneur.
I completely agree, because if it's almost like, for example, like when I was, you know, growing the technology services at Imaging Path, it was like having to like cheerlead all day long about the vision of the company, where we're going, and getting people to run through walls takes a ton of effort and a ton of emotional energy to get everybody on board, to always be preaching. And what if you go home one day and you're like, I'm not really sure if I've totally jived with that vision anymore. Like, what do you tell everybody? Just like, hey, by the way, it's shifting gears or something's different. So you've almost like committed yourself into this box, if that's the case. And so I think what happens is people feel like they've got, you know, some sort of commitment to themselves and to their people, where shifting and reinventing themselves in that scenario is like some sort of negative perception or negative.
Yeah, you can't change your mind. You have to sing the company song the whole way through.
Right, exactly.
I've also seen it go the other way, where you have a leader who does a lot of shifting and pivoting, and you lose people the other direction too. It's too fast and lean, and your team is like, what are we doing now? Like, they don't know how to answer customer service calls. They don't know what to implement because there's not clarity. And I think the challenge of finding the strength within yourself to be clear-headed and committed to a course of action, but then also know how to change well and trust yourself when it's time to make a change. I mean, that's a level of wisdom and nuance that it's not easy to come by. And most of us don't walk in the door with those skills intact.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really just comes down to what's important to you. I mean, which takes work, like you just said, and it takes a lot of courage. And if you know what's important to you, then it shouldn't be a surprise if you slightly pivot a little bit, because it should align with what's important to you, you know, and that's, you know, personally and with the business. And again, if the business is a reflection of you, you know, you should be able to, it should make sense, I guess.
Yeah. In your transition process, you mentioned that your fifth pillar is team. Who's been essential to you on your team as you've gone from one company to the other?
So mine is the boring logical team. So I'm just going to say, because I'm assuming you're looking from the support structure, and that is for sure my wife. Like, because my dad was going through his shit too. So like, he was like, it'd be like two people like drowning in trying to save each other. Whereas in my wife, like totally, it was communication and her knowing that I was happier trying to figure out who I am outside of, you know, going and working a big job was just huge, and allowed me to morph into what I'm doing now without being upset that I'm changing.
How does she communicate her support for you?
Oh my gosh. We talk a lot, honestly. And it's knowing, like, so I work from home half the time when I'm doing shows like this or, you know, other calls and stuff. And knowing that we've got 2 1-year-old girl twins upstairs, and that I don't feel the guilt of that I have to go up there, and just knowing that, like, I will work late some nights because I'm at events or doing a company party or whatever it might be, and that it's part of the deal. And I think it is that she knows that I will do whatever it takes to not have to do that. So it's kind of the constant balance, knowing that I'm not just using it as an excuse to not be around.
There's trust in your teamwork, right? There's trust that she's doing her thing for the family, you're doing your thing for the family, and you have some of the same end goals in mind. And yeah, your trust that you're building something together.
Yep. There's just no, I don't know how else you could do it. No chance.
Yeah. Yeah. How about your practical boring team?
You know, it's an interesting, you know, I've got some pretty solid opinions about this. The team needs all, it's whoever understands your whole picture. Maybe I'll go into where we ran into challenges that, you know, I had to have an investment banker sitting there, and, you know, they get paid to sell your company. So what are they really, it really just follow the motivations. It follow the money and you'll find the motivations of all your professionals. So whether it's the CPA, you know, they might be a wonderful person, but they get paid to do audits and to do tax returns. Your banker gets paid to do loans and to do deposits. Your attorney gets paid to bill. You know, all these people, like, they might have some bigger picture, but there's a lot of lack of optimization behind that. And so I think realistically, it's starting with whoever you trust most and trying to explain to them what you're trying to do. And hopefully that person will bring in the other people that'll allow you to look at the whole picture and weigh the different opportunities and options next to each other.
Yeah. I do think this is a really hard thing about the sale of the business. It was definitely hard for us. Rob and I talked about this in the context of the sale of Drip, and we recorded a couple podcasts about it about a year ago, but it was very, very hard to trust the people at the table and to know whether what they were saying was legitimate or not. And that, you know, that even came down to Clay, who was then the CEO of Lead Pages, who acquired Drip, and this sense of like, are you a good guy or not? You seem like you could be a good guy, but we're not sure. So we're kind of inclined not to believe anything you say. And then, you know, a year later, we know him and we're like, yeah, you're totally a good guy. But you just don't know at that point. And I think that drives so much of the anxiety. So trying to figure out who is your trustworthy team is a major way to alleviate anxiety in the context of a sale.
You know, my analogy is, Sherry, is that, like, you know, when you're trying to sell your company, you're trying to continue running it while you're selling it, usually, because you can't stop doing either of them. So my analogy that I give is selling a business is like kind of like a, would you ever build a building without a blueprint or a budget? No. Because it's like, okay, well, I need to know how much I'm going to spend on this building, call it $1 million. Okay, well, now you can back into all of the materials and infrastructure you need to get to that. And then you would sit down with an architect that says, okay, you know, you're weighing things. You don't want granite? Do you not want granite? Do you want these appliances? Not these appliances. Do you want, you know, I don't know, $80,000 sunroof or whatever? I mean, all these different things are weighed back and forth between the plan and then the budget. And then once you're done with that, then you go hire the contractors who then do the HVAC, electrical, the plumbing, because it falls into context of the plan and the budget. Where what happens, I believe, which I fell victim to, and it sounds kind of like you felt it, whether it was the stress, is you're also trying to be the general contractor of your sale as well as running your company, as well as trying to sell your company. So it's just, I think it's trying to see who will weigh those decisions, which is, again, what our firm is trying to do is, okay, you might get less money if you sell to this company, but your employees are going to be fine. You know, your investment banker might not want that because it directly affects their commission. So it's being able to weigh all those different decisions. I think that is huge.
Yeah. And I think another thing I really like about what you're doing, and I think is really important, is to help entrepreneurs go into the process with their eyes wide open about the possible ways that this might end. I don't think that many of us think very much about that. You know, I'll tell you the truth. I'm all systems go on Zen Founder. I'm building this, you know, this little consulting company, and I have no idea how it's going to end. I guess someday I'll just shut it down. I don't know. I haven't thought about that. And I'm not trying to get free consulting from you, but I do think that that's a super, super important conversation for people to have in their heads from the beginning, certainly earlier on, so that they know their options and know their choices. And I love that you and your team are helping people to think through that in a meaningful way. I think it's again, great information for people to have at the beginning.
It's starting with the end in mind. You know, I mean, that's any plan is like that. And a lot of us entrepreneurs don't do that. We go risk and mortgage everything and we go, well, let's do this.
Right. sell.
It's like, right. Whereas in, like, you know, one of my things in the speech is, okay, Google Maps is one of the most powerful tools on the planet. What happens if you don't plug in point B?
You go nowhere.
Nothing. Like, literally nothing. It just sits there, right? That's exactly the same thing where, like, you can't, I mean, if you were to plug in a quick trip that you wanted to go to at the gas station in between, you know, your point A and point B, but you didn't have it calibrated, you could end up like half across the U.S. potentially. So every decision, if you know where you're going and why, every decision, whether it's emotionally or financially, will make an impact on where you want to go because you're able to put it in the context of the grander plan. So it's thinking about, what does it feel like to be at the end? How do I emotionally want to be? Who do I want to be around? What are the things I want to accomplish? And then back into all of that.
And it makes great sense. And I think it does alleviate a lot of anxiety and sort of existential angst when you have some of those values laid out as well as some potential options laid out for yourself.
Right. And what you're doing is what the, like, mentally, where do you want to be? Because that's the, literally nothing can be done if, unless you emotionally and mentally know who you are and what you want, because otherwise it's all just a moot point.
Yeah. So thank you so much for talking with me. If people want to get in touch with you, or they feel like they need some of your help and services, how can they find you? I know you also have a podcast, so tell us where we can find that.
So my podcast is called Life After Business. Hopefully that seems now kind of fitting, because it's all of the stuff that I wish I would have known. And that is also on iTunes, Stitcher. It's on my website, which is mysolidity.com. And then my cell phone is 612-720-6530. And my email is ryan@mysolidity.com, which is mysolidity.
All right. And we can put some of that info in the show notes too, so people can, if they didn't write it down, if you're driving, if you're listening and driving, you can find it. It'll be okay. Don't worry. Don't crash. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you so much. Oh, I had a blast, Sherry. Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.